Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Alastair McLeod. He is head of research for Gold Money and an Austrian economist from the Austrian School of Economics Approach. He has a background as a stockbroker, banker, and fund manager. Welcome, Alastair.
That's my pleasure, Richard.
Great. So today I thought we would focus internationally on a number of topics that you have written about and what's happening geopolitically. One article, you talk about the international coordination of monetary policies and how that has increased the potential scale of the next credit crisis. Can you elaborate on that, how that could possibly be?
Yes, certainly, Richard. The first thing I think to understand is that the business cycle which the central banks are trying to manage is actually not a business cycle. It's a cycle of credit, which is actually created by the central banks themselves. Now, the reason we know this is just imagine an economy which works with sound money. In other words, there's no expansion and contraction of bank credit. There is no expansion of raw money out of the central bank to try and stimulate the economy or whatever. Let's just assume that you have a sound money economy. And under those circumstances, there really cannot be what we call a business cycle, simply because everything is random. You get the creative destruction that Schumpeter described, the process, if you like, of businesses which are ill-founded or making things which people don't want. When they go to the wall, they do so in a random basis. There is no sort of cyclical behavior as such. Now we have the central banks. The central bank comes in, and what does it do? It feels that the economy is not performing strongly enough. So it encourages the banks to, or it gives a license to the banks to create credit. The banks therefore create credit, and so suddenly you've got extra money going into the economy. So instead of people actually having to make a choice between this and that, they can have both this and that. The creative destruction you see in an economy gets postponed, if you like. So the result is that you've got the creative destruction bit accumulating the whole time underneath the hood. And eventually what happens is that the excess credit in the economy suddenly has to come to a halt. And it comes to a halt for a variety of reasons. The most understandable one is that an expansion of credit tends to fuel prices. Prices start rising. The central bank is trying to manage the whole show, and so they have to raise interest rates, and they raise interest rates to the point where the cycle has to turn. So essentially, what I'm saying here is that the cycle of credit is what creates what we believe to be a business cycle. It is actually a credit cycle. So the point about central banks is that they coordinate their stimulation of the economy and their attempts to stop the economy overheating, I'll put it in those terms. And so you have the G7, you have the G10. We now, after the last crisis, we had the G20. You've also got the bi-monthly meetings at the Bank of International Settlements, where the senior central bankers meet and discuss things, if you like, in private. The effect of this is that they all do the same thing at the same time. So, you know, instead of having a sea where you get sort of random waves coming into the shore, you know, you start getting something like a tsunami, as it were. You know, you get a global tsunami of credit coming in. And we're then surprised when the whole thing suddenly sort of goes from being totally dry to being completely flooded. And it is essentially a credit cycle, and it is made worse by the coordination of central bank policy. And that was the point I made.
So what is the implication of this to relative currency exchange values and, importantly, to gold, as well as the purchasing power of those currencies?
Well, the effect on the currencies depends on, I suppose, on the amount of stimulation that an individual central bank gives to its economy. And on top of that, you've got, if you like, what people actually do with the currency. Do they think the purchasing power is going to go down? In other words, prices rise. And, you know, the cycle basically is that. It's a sort of change in purchasing power of the currencies the whole time, really driven by this cycle of credit. You know, it because what happens is, underneath this, you get an accumulation of debt which never gets washed out on this credit cycle, because the idea, you know, once you sort of raise interest rates to the point where the economy suddenly shudders to a halt, what happens? You start lowering interest rates, trying to expand the quantity of money in the economy to stop everybody going bankrupt. And so the, you know, and generally central banks succeed in that because they just chuck money at the problem. And if you remember the great financial crisis, the Fed effectively wrote an open check. And I remember at the time, I sort of calculated that the value of this open-ended check was roughly $13 trillion. Now, how much of it was drawn down, I don't know, but most of it was. The effect of this is to defer the destruction of this debt, which is completely unproductive. So it rolls over into the next cycle. So every time it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's all a credit cycle. It's nothing to do with the business cycle. It's a credit cycle. Then you find that, I mean, last time we had the great financial crisis, what's happened since then? You only look at the statistics and you can see that the amount of debt that's built up, government, private sector, shadow banking, and all the rest of it, has increased immeasurably in the 9 years since then. And so the next financial crisis is going to be worse than the last one. It always is, until suddenly, you know, the whole thing gets absolutely collapsed and we have to start again. And that probably is what's likely to happen in the future. Now, you asked the question about gold. The protection the ordinary person has against, if you like, fiat currency losing its purchasing power under these sort of growing tsunamis of credit and debt is to hold sound money, which is gold. And gold is money. It's not an investment. It is money. And you hold that because you want something to be able to use as money when paper currencies either lose substantially their value or alternatively lose all their value. Gold is, in that sense, gives you the best protection, more than anything else, more than assets such as property, more than assets such as stocks and shares. Gold is money. Gold is sound money. And if you want to insulate yourself to some degree from the problems of the collapse of a paper currency, which is going to happen. I mean, it may not happen next time, but it is going to happen. Then gold is the only thing that you can really use. Silver as well, maybe. Silver has been demonetized, so you've got to go through a stage of it being remonetized before it really has that value, which I think will happen. But the only sound money that we really have in the markets at the moment is gold. And that's physical gold, by the way, not paper gold.
Yeah, it seems to be like there's two levers in this all this debt, namely the quantity of that credit debt and also the interest rates. So obviously, as interest rates go down, the credit debt can go higher, you know, while keeping the servicing costs low. But at some point, you sort of get boxed in, right, where there's just too much, either too much debt or the interest rates rise to some point where the debt is no longer serviceable.
Yes, that's right. I mean, getting boxed in, I think, is a very good description, because you ask yourself now the question, at what level would the Fed funds rate have to rise in order to trigger the next credit crisis? I believe that level is in the region of 2.5%, which is not very far above the current level. But the other thing we learn from understanding that this is a credit cycle, not a business cycle, is the credit cycle will continue. It's So, and the credit cycle is really comprised of stimulation, inflation, having to destimulate, and you destimulate to the point where you collapse things because there's no fine line behind, you know, between sort of slowing things down, if you like, and actually creating the next crisis. You can't just slow things down because it's not enough of a response to kill price inflation. All that happens if you raise interest rates a bit is the markets turn around and say, well, the central bank's obviously too terrified to raise interest rates enough to deal with inflation. Therefore, we're going to continue to advance our purchases. We're going to continue to, if you like, dispose of money in favor of goods, which basically is the driver behind reducing the purchasing power of currency. And the only way the Bank of England, the Fed, the Bank of Japan, the ECB can stop it is to raise interest rates to the level where we change our behavior. And this, after all, was what Volcker did back in 1980-81.
But then as you raise it too much, that gets into the difficulty in the burden of governments, especially to service their growing, escalating levels of debt, plus the potential for derivatives crisis in the interest rate swap market, right? Because you've got so many derivatives for $500 trillion, right, in notional value. So you got those two potential problems to look at.
Yes, on every cycle, and on every credit cycle, you're going to have these problems. And, you know, the problems are just getting larger and larger every time, because the job of the central bank is to act as lender of last resort and to ensure the eau d'or does not hit the fan. So what happens is they create the collapse. You know, it's just the credit cycle. They raise interest rates to the point where the collapse occurs, and then they crash interest rates and chuck money into the economy to ensure that nobody goes bust. And it is the most ridiculous situation. And the idea that central banks think that they can actually manage what they think is a business cycle is just completely bizarre. I mean, every time you've got to have the collapse. And I mean, as you rightly say, you've got a derivatives position, you've got, you know, all these things, they're so much larger than last time. I mean, you've got governments effectively are stuck in a debt trap as well. You know, interest rates got to be raised until everybody sort of panics and suddenly they have to change their behavior. And it's, but the problem, what we've got to look through is next time round, how much money, given that the Fed had to create an open check, which amounted to roughly $13 trillion last time, how much money does the Fed have to write an open check for this time? And what is going to be the effect on the dollar? And the dollar, after all, is the currency to which all the other currencies tie themselves. They don't tie themselves to gold anymore. So if the dollar falls, we all fall. You know, I would posit that this time round, it's going to be considerably worse than last time round. And I say that remembering that there were moments when I sort of thought, oh my God, how are we going to get out of this one?
The timing of this next credit crisis, would that necessarily be based upon your 2.5% figure on the Fed funds rate, or could other factors come in before that time?
Other factors could come in because the whole situation has become quite unstable. I mean, I've been looking at Europe quite closely, and there is, if you like, a movement of money away from the banking systems in Italy and Spain in particular. Also, of course, Greece and Portugal, but the big countries are Italy and Spain, into principally Germany, but also Luxembourg, followed by Finland, followed by the Netherlands. These banking systems are, as far as large depositors concerned, safe relative to the banks in the Mediterranean countries. This has now hit record levels. I mean, it is just incredible the level at which this flight of capital from the banking systems in these weaker countries, it's just got pretty well out of control. Now, the ECB is sitting on the situation saying, oh, it's not a problem. The ECB has the eventual liability for the settlement system, which is reflecting these imbalances. And that's the Target 2 settlement system, which is basically run by the ECB. It's a settlement system which exists between the ECB and the various national central banks. Now, what happens is that if money, let us say, leaves, let's take, for example, a bank in Italy, then, you know, the bank in Italy finds that its balance sheet is under strain. So it goes to the Banca d'Italia, the central bank, and effectively it borrows money to build, you know, to cover the deposits that have gone out. The Banca d'Italia effectively, it ends up, if you like, with an asset on its balance sheet, which is a loan to the commercial bank, and against that it has a deficit, if you like, on its Target 2 settlement. And that's how these deficits add up. On the other side of the coin, what happens is that you've taken your money out of the Italian bank, you've redeposited it in a German bank, let's say. And the German bank ends up with excess deposits, which it deposits in the Bundesbank. So the Bundesbank ends up with a liability. In other words, the commercial bank's reserves on the balance sheet of the Bundesbank is a liability to the Bundesbank because it owes it to the commercial bank. And it marries that with a credit on the Target 2 system. So this is why the Bundesbank, at the moment, I think the surplus it has on the Target 2 system is in the region of 840 billion euros. So this is a system which actually should be broadly in balance. We got these huge, huge figures. The total imbalance, I think I'm quoting off the top of my head, is in the region, I think, of about 1.8 trillion. I think it's about 1.34 trillion. Euros. I mean, this should not happen. It really should not happen. And the important point also to bear in mind is that the statistics coming out of the Eurozone show that there is economic recovery going on. So if you've got economic recovery going on, why do you have the continual flight of capital? This is a concern. And I think that let's hope that Brexit and all the rest of it doesn't actually sort of create a crisis of confidence in the Eurozone. But I would just say that it is actually a mounting risk, if you like, to the global banking and financial system. This is the sort of thing that you've got to keep an eye on. Lots of other people would say that China is a real problem. China is certainly a problem. China has big problems because it has inflated its credit to a very considerable extent. What it is now trying to do is it is trying to deflate a bubble on its domestic market while inflating another bubble as it's indulging in infrastructure spending, not only in China itself, but also throughout the Asian continent. The annual spend on infrastructure is now in the order of $750 billion equivalent. That's what's going on. That's why you've got the demand for the commodities coming out of China. But China, in trying to manage this situation, she finds that the wealth funds have been front-running her by buying commodities because everybody knows the Chinese government is buying commodities, so I'm going to buy these damn things first.
Right.
The Chinese government is not very happy with this and is basically killing these these wealth management products, if you like. So this is really what's behind the fall in commodity prices recently, and why silver has been really slaughtered. But that'll come to an end, and it'll come to an end, I should think, after about a month or two, and then commodity prices will resume their rise up. So this we've got to watch this credit. This credit is something that is getting more and more difficult for central banks to manage. And the fact that the amount of credit that's involved, of course, the other side of credit is debt, means that the whole situation is becoming very unstable. You can have, it's the old chaos theory, a butterfly flapping its wings in the Brazilian jungle can create a storm in Arizona, whatever.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I mean, literally, I think we've got to really be very vigilant. vigilant as to how these credit imbalances really develop and where they develop and where they're likely to create trouble.
So in addition to these internationally coordinated monetary policies and other factors, we've got government policies that are also influencing the financial system and the currency market. Can you speak to the effect of how the U.S. dollar in particular interacts geopolitically, namely what has recently happened in North Korea, what could happen in Iran?
Well, this is a fascinating one, because if you pick up on on China's view as to what America is doing, you get a very different view from what's reported in the mainstream media in the West. The Chinese have worked out that America gains a huge amount from exporting the dollar, which costs it absolutely nothing, for value. And this we all know and we understand. But they take it one step further and say, when the Americans need to raise funds, what they need to do is to encourage those dollars back to invest in U.S. treasuries. And the way they do this is they destabilize the region where the dollars have gone to. The first example that Major General Chiao Liang, who is the chief strategist for the People's Liberation Army, first place he identified was Latin America back in the 1970s. He went on to say that the reason that you had the Argentinian coup d'etat and Allende in Chile and the coup d'etat, the military takeover after that and all the rest of it, was as a result of American policy to try and get those dollars back in to finance America's needs. Now, I actually don't buy into that. I mean, again, it's actually a credit cycle. It's actually as simple as that. But I won't deny the effect. The effect that the Chinese have identified is correct. They then went on to say that the same thing happened with the Asian crisis at the tail end of the last century. And again, I would say that that is a credit cycle, and that was very much homegrown. We could argue about what triggered the end, but the fact is there was an excess of credit. But the way the Chinese look at it, their analysis, in terms of results, is correct. So this is interesting, because we now move on. We're now in a situation where Donald Trump gets elected, which is very good for him. I hope it's good for America. But one of the big problems he has is that he can't raise any money because the debt limit has been reached and it's not being extended. He's got a mixture of Democrats who hate his guts, and he's also got Republicans, of which there is an element, if you like, of free marketeers, libertarians, and all the rest of it, who don't want to extend the debt. So how do you get to extend the debt? What the Chinese would say is, well, you destabilize a region where the dollars are, and those dollars are going to come flooding back. That's fine. But you've still got to get Congress on your side. Well, the way you do that is you play the patriotic card. And this is where North Korea comes in. The target is not actually North Korea. The target is to get the dollars out of South Korea and also out of Japan. But the way you do it is you wage war, or you threaten to wage war, on North Korea. And then what happens is that your Congress, and remember, he got 100 members of Congress or senators or whatever to come to a meeting in the White House for a briefing. Basically, no American can actually go against the idea of patriotism. So he got the extension up to October. That's what that was about. And I think this is a fascinating situation, because it also explains why Donald Trump moved from peacenik to warmonger in a space of less than 100 days. I mean, it is just a remarkable conversion. Iran, he was also rattling the sabers on Iran. And I suspect that Iran is also going to be, if you like, that's likely to be sort of ramped up probably later on this year when he wants to extend and increase the budget deficit after October. And the reason Iran? Well, it's quite simple. The ownership of dollars, one of the areas where there are lots and lots of dollars owned is the Middle East. And the way you shake it out is and into US treasuries without having to raise interest rates by very much, by the way, is to destabilize the Middle East. This is the Chinese analysis. And at this stage, I'm beginning to think, yeah, I think they got a damn good point.
And what about China and Russia in terms of their involvement with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, how that plays out with respect to the U.S. dollar and gold? And you recently mentioned that there's some developments by China in terms of moving to pricing energy in gold terms.
Yeah, well, there's so many aspects of this. Let me start with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That is the big story, which very few people in the West really understand. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is basically set up by China and Russia. I would say that the lead country in this is China, but these two countries, Russia and China, basically run the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It started as, if you like, as an intelligence and security sort of enterprise, not enterprise, but agreement, if you like, between these two countries, the idea being that they didn't want to have the sort of the Chechnya Muslim rebellion type thing spreading. They wanted to control all that. But it then quite rapidly morphed at the beginning of this century from that starting point into an economic unit. And basically the idea is that the whole of Asia will become a free trade area. China has the technology. It's now building its own technology. It has the manufacturing capacity. Russia has the resources. And between them, they are creating an industrial revolution throughout the most populous continent in the world. The countries that are aligned with this but have yet to join formally, like Iran, India, Pakistan, the Southeast Asian bloc is sort of on their own, but they are tied into it because there is a Chinese diaspora there. So we're talking really about 40% of the world's population suddenly are going to have this industrial revolution, which is going to link the whole continent. This is actually also impinging on Europe. I don't know if your listeners are aware, but China is now sending trains with containers on them from Beijing to London, Beijing to Madrid. It takes roughly 2 weeks to get a container from Beijing to Madrid at the moment. That is going to be cut down. They will get it down to something like a week, 10 days. Now, that compares with shipping the containers by sea, which takes 3 weeks, 3-4 weeks. Exactly. So you can see how the rail communications, which is this new spice road thing, the investment in this is absolutely mega. Now, the other thing which is very important is that all the capital investment that is going to create this industrial revolution in Asia has got to be financed. That is why the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank was set up by China and Russia jointly. And that is why Britain was the first country to knock on the door and say, we're in. This was under the previous Conservative administration. Now the reason this is terribly important is that all that infrastructure development has to be financed. London is the center from which it is going to be financed. As far as the Chinese and the Russians are concerned, they do not want America involved at all. New York is frozen out of this completely for the very simple reason that everything they do is reflected in bank balances back in the American banking system. They don't want dollars. They don't want American interference. They don't want Americans telling them or double guessing what they're doing the whole time. They would rather keep them out of it. So London, working with a twin nexus of Hong Kong, is, if you like, the way all this is being financed. And this is desperately important because I think that the investment banks who are sort of looking at London and thinking, oh, well, you know, Brexit and all the rest of it, it's not going to be so exciting in London. They're missing the point. The big, big game is no longer Europe. The big, big game is the whole of Asia.
And what would be the effect of this on the exchanges in Shanghai in terms of the gold exchange and other futures type exchanges priced in yuan and in gold?
Yeah, well, that was the second part of your question, which I didn't address. Now, what China has been trying to do is to try and promote the yuan as an international trade settlement currency. It's got a long way to go. I mean, the dollar dominates this market absolutely and completely. But one way in which they, the Chinese can promote the yuan is to ensure that there are efficient financial markets which will allow people to do with the yuan what they can do with the dollar. Now, one of the things that they have done at the outset is to set up a yuan gold contract in the futures market in Shanghai, settled in physical gold. Important point. This means that I could take, you know, as someone who has exported goods to China, I could take yuan in settlement, and while the deal is sort of progressing, I can sell those yuan forward through the futures market in Shanghai on the gold contract in order to pick up gold. Now, that might not excite me terribly at the moment, but we now have another thing which has been actually postponed because I think the Chinese authorities realize the importance of this. It's a lot more than they originally thought, and that is an oil contract in yuan. Now, think about this. If, let's say, Saudi Arabia sells oil to China, gets paid in yuan, or gets a forward contract to be paid in yuan, it can sell its oil for yuan and change those yuan into gold across the futures exchanges. So immediately you've got gold priced in oil again. You've got oil priced in gold, which it goes back to the pre-1971 Nixon shock, when, you know, before then the price of oil was basically tied to the price of gold because of the convertibility, if you like, through the central banks and supranationals could enjoy. So we're getting back to that situation. And America's response to this is really yet to be seen. I mean, they've been on the back foot the whole time on this one. But the one thing that is becoming clear to me is that the future major economy in the world is going to be Asia, the whole of Asia, and in order to promote the yuan, if you like, at the expense of the dollar, there has got to be some form of a gold, gold conversion, gold option, whatever, for trade purposes. Only when that happens can the dollar be knocked off its pedestal as the major trade settlement currency. And that basically is what the Chinese are working towards. And incidentally, it's why Russia is adding so furiously to its gold reserves all the time.
Yeah, because what would be the implications for gold prices in U.S. dollar terms if all of this plays out?
Well, I think what we're looking at is there is going to come a point where China, if it's going to say offer a gold option on trade settlement, then there's no point in doing that at the current gold price. If you want to do it at a gold price, it's got to be a far higher level. So I would see that the Chinese would move towards a higher level. Now, the problem they have is they don't want to destabilize the world economically. The easiest way to destabilize the world economically is to raise the price of gold, say, to $4,000 an ounce or something, whatever the figure is. It would actually collapse the Western financial system. This is why they're reluctant to do it. It's almost like a nuclear option. But as things evolve, I think they're getting closer and closer towards having to take that decision. Well, I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't think they want a violent transition, but to an extent, it depends what America does. I mean, China owns an awful lot of U.S. treasuries. I think it's about $1 trillion worth. Now, you know, they're going to have to write those off at some stage. Now, either they write them off in the sense that America stops them selling. In other words, it won't authorize a transfer of ownership of China's treasuries, in which case, you know, China just has to wait for them to mature and then just not reinvest the proceeds. But that's too slow. That's far too slow for China's plans. Or alternatively, China's got to force the pace. And I think we're getting closer to the point where some sort of decision has to be taken.
Well, this is fascinating discussion and a great insight on the international developments, trends that are happening, and the linkages to the financial system. Alistair, we thank you very much for being on the program show. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Goldmoney.com. If you go onto the Wealth tab on the front page, you'll find that all the research is underneath that. And I write weekly. It's published in sort of, I suppose, late morning, early afternoon, Eastern time. That's on Thursday. That's the sort of insight article that I write weekly. And I also do a market report on precious metals, which is published on the following Friday.
Great. Thank you very much again, Alistair. Thank you.
That's my pleasure, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.